deal with what she felt was coming. The United States doesn't really have a public health system, she said. It has 5,000 dots, and each one of those dots serves at the will of an elected official. She sat down in her bedroom to write her birthday resolutions and painstakingly transferred them to the back of her grandmother's photograph, which hung beside her desk in Sacramento. It was December 21st, 2019. She'd spent the previous few months asking herself why she'd ever come here. But now she felt this premonition. It resembled the feeling she sometimes had at the start of an outbreak back in Santa Barbara County. It always starts with one case and an eerie silence, she said. None of her resolutions of the previous 15 years was anything but an expression of personal goals. Play the piano again. Get my sea legs in this new job. Go to Africa. She began this year's list with one deeply personal goal. Then, on the second line, she made a prediction. It has started, she wrote. Part 2. 6. The Red Phone. He'd just been reading the news like everyone else. He had no special access to any new disease outbreak, and no one would have expected him to intervene. All that Joe DeRisi had was his new lab at the University of California, San Francisco, and what seemed to him an almost magical new weapon for hunting viruses. Joe described his lab as a do-it-yourself maker fair. He talked about the weapon as just one of the cool things they'd made, and were still figuring out how and where best to deploy. Then Joe read about the new outbreak in China. On February 10, 2003, the Beijing office of the World Health Organization received an email about a strange contagious disease in Guangdong province. The flu-like disease was killing at a rate that the flu never had. It sickened children as well as adults. It infected people who knew enough to try to protect themselves from it. An Italian doctor named Carlo Urbani, detailed by WHO to investigate the outbreak, died before he could figure out what killed him. When Joe read about the Italian doctor, he put what he was working on to one side and looked for a way into this new game. We got in touch with the CDC, said Joe. And we said, we have this new chip thing, and we might be able to help identify the pathogen. By then, weeks into the outbreak, the CDC was playing a leading role in a frantic investigation. They were initially dismissive, said Joe. They'd never heard of Joe DeRisi or his chip thing. It was the last time Joe or his chip thing would be a secret. The next year, he'd receive a MacArthur Genius Grant, and his office phone would be ringing so often and with such urgency that he'd start calling it the Red Phone. But to the CDC, in March 2003, Joe DeRisi was just another young research biochemist on the make. The chip thing he'd created, well, no one outside of the DeRisi lab knew much about it. We literally had to beg the CDC to send us a sample of the virus, said Joe. But they finally sent us a sample. The sample resided in a chunk of lung taken from a person who'd died of the new disease. To Joe's surprise, the CDC shipped the lung in an ordinary FedEx box. Weekend delivery. Until a new pathogen is formally identified, the CDC explained, it remains classified as just another benign packet of genetic material. Joe realized too late that the UCSF Package Reception Center was closed on weekends. Some guy in a FedEx truck carrying a chunk of lung from a human being who had recently died of a deadly airborne disease would be cruising around the UCSF campus searching for a way in. The Saturday morning of delivery, Joe and his postdoctoral students staked out the streets. It was Joe who spotted the FedEx truck and stopped it. Dude, he shouted at the driver. Do you have a box for the DeRisi lab? The driver gave him a look. Joe was then 33 years old, but could have passed for 23. Seemingly carefree, radically informal. Most days he dressed in the same uniform of running shoes, cargo shorts, and a t-shirt with some random thing printed on the front. He could pass more easily as a surfer or a skater or some other category of person who routinely called other people dude than a guy with his own biochemistry lab and a new weapon for hunting viruses. The first impression was deceptive. 3 years earlier, he'd been handpicked by UCSF's faculty to skip the usual postdoc stage of formal scientific training and been given his own lab, because they didn't want to waste a moment of his mind. "It's a mind without boundaries," said Don Ganem, a UCSF microbiologist and medical doctor who had pushed for DeRisi's hire. "It's a mind that is interested in everything and afraid of nothing. It's a bandwidth that is hard for most people to fathom." Actually, the first impression made by Joe didn't linger all that long. Something he did or said usually gave him away. As the FedEx driver retrieved the box, which he now noticed came from a place called the Centers for Disease Control, Joe reached into his cargo shorts and extracted a pair of thick laboratory safety gloves. Suddenly, Joe did not seem like a man without a care in the world. Clearly, he cared very much about not touching the FedEx box with his bare hands. At that moment, the FedEx delivery guy could be forgiven for asking a question. "If this dude thinks he needs gloves even to touch the box, how come I don't?" Instead of asking it, he asked another, "Hey, what's in the box?" "Oh, it's nothing," said Joe. The driver looked at him again. "I'm never coming back here," he said. That was a very Joe moment, a twofer, like the double helix. He now had not only the chunk of human lung, but a funny story about how he got it. Then he went to work on the lung. 24 hours later, his lab had identified the pathogen that had killed its original owner, a new coronavirus. Back in March 2003, this was shocking news. No one had ever heard of a coronavirus causing severe illness in people. Coronaviruses could be deadly to animals, but in people they'd always manifested themselves as the common cold. The World Health Organization would eventually give the disease caused by this coronavirus its name: Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, or SARS. "After that, I was hooked," said Joe. "I said, I want to do more of this." Joe sensed that the CDC was stunned by what the DeRisi lab had done and by how quickly they'd done it. It felt less like science than magic. The CDC would also eventually identify the new coronavirus. But it would take them many weeks to do what an unknown biochemist at UCSF with no training in virology had done in hours. "No one knew about our technology or what we were doing," said Joe. "It just wasn't on anyone's mind." But now it was. And so was Joe. Not long after SARS, the ringing of the red phone commenced. Ditto the letters and emails with their often bizarre requests. For instance, at the end of 2003, Joe got an email from a man claiming to be a senior officer in the United States Navy. "We would like you to come to D.C. and talk to the Jasons," it began. The note was short and to the point, and the point was that the Jasons wanted Joe to explain how this new biological threat had crept up on humanity and how the DeRisi lab had identified it. "My first question," said Joe, "is who the fuck are the Jasons?" Googling, he found mostly websites promoting conspiracy theories. "Whatever QAnon was back then, that's what I got," said Joe. "It was all deep state stuff." At length, he stumbled upon a source that sounded at least faintly credible. The Jasons, it explained, were a shadowy group of scientists and military leaders who met in secret in Washington, D.C. I thought, hell, I can't turn this down, said Joe. A few months later, he flew to Dulles Airport, where he found waiting for him a black SUV with the Navy guy inside of it. On the drive to wherever they were going, the Navy guy said next to nothing. I think, whatever, this dude is just weird, said Joe. The car dropped them in front of a glass office building in Tyson's Corner, Virginia. A man behind a glass counter handed Joe a badge. I notice it has a color code, and my color is different than the Navy guy's, said Joe. The Navy guy then passed Joe to an old white guy. The old white guy escorted Joe down halls and around corners and through security checkpoints until finally they entered an elevator and descended. In the middle of a lot of awkward silence, Joe noticed the name on the old guy's security badge. Jason. Like the Navy dude, he was a man of few words, but as they descended into what felt like Middle Earth, this dude who was clearly not named Jason turned to Joe and said, "It's cool, huh?" After Joe agreed that, yes, it was indeed cool, the old guy said, "It's like going down the rabbit hole, son." The old guy said not another word until they arrived inside a small auditorium. Maybe 150 seats. All filled by old white men, many in military uniforms. It was generals and stuff, said Joe. The old guy handed Joe a sheet of paper with the titles of the many presentations to be given to the old men that day. Each talk was color-coded to indicate the security clearance level required to hear it. Before Joe even asked the question, the old guy said, "We will make sure you leave the room." That's how Joe learned that the only talk that he had the security clearance to hear was his own. The talk after his own, he noticed, was called the Night Fist. "I wanted to stay and hear that one," said Joe. "I mean, who wouldn't want to stay and find out what the Night Fist was?" As he walked to the podium, Joe noticed that the guys in the front row weren't merely on the old side. They were ancient, and now so close that he could read their name badges, too. Jason. Every person in the room was pretending to be named Jason, and Joe, officially, was now having the time of his life. "I'm thinking, this is real. This is cool. This is Tom Clancy shit," he said. Whoever the Jasons actually were, they'd allotted him just 10 minutes to explain how he and his team at UCSF had so quickly identified the virus that had eventually killed hundreds of people in Hong Kong and mainland China. 10 minutes to describe what was less a technology than a worldview evolved over years in Joe's mind. From the sounds of the talks to be given that day, he could see that the scientists were mostly physicists, not his crowd. He was relieved that he'd prepared to explain his work to a lay audience, as that's what this was, in spite of all the drama. He began by telling them about his new technology. "Until now," he explained, "the identification of a new virus has been a tedious, slow-moving process. The trouble with viruses is that they're so very small. You need a lot of virus before you can see it, even with an electron microscope, magnifying it several million times over. Virus extracted from some infected human is seldom sufficient, and so virologists usually need to take whatever they find and then grow more. To grow virus, they need first to find an animal in which virus will grow. They inject a tiny bit of live virus into a mouse, for example, and hope that it replicates. If the virus fails to replicate inside the mouse, they move on to some other animal. It's a pain in the ass just to get enough virus so you can see it. Only after you have it can you form a hypothesis about what the virus might be. Your hypothesis needs to be tested, and each test might take a day or more. If the test comes back negative, that is, if the virologist has guessed wrong, the process starts all over again. One down, dozens to go. It's a fishing expedition, said Joe. They're just hoping that whatever they see reminds them of something they've seen before. But what if it's something entirely new or something you've never seen before? Then you're in trouble. The human mind was simply no match for nature's variety. Nature was full of surprises that no scientist, however smart, could predict. You start looking only for things that you are trained to expect, said Joe, and you miss what's there. The new chip created by the DeRisi lab did not require him to grow enough virus so that he could see it. The new chip also removed the prediction part of the investigation and allowed science to proceed without hypotheses. The new chip allowed the human mind to escape its boundaries. The viro chip, as it was called, was actually a glass microscope slide. Its surface held genetic sequences from every known virus. These sequences, along with the genetic information of living creatures, were stored in a federally funded database called GenBank inside the National Institutes of Health. GenBank amounted to a massive gene library updated every 2 weeks by scientists from all over the world. It's like a puzzle store where you can walk around and look at the pictures on the boxes, said Joe. A few of the puzzle pictures were complete, like the picture of human beings as the human genome had been fully sequenced. But most of the pictures were partial, including those of many viruses. The DeRisi lab had grabbed from GenBank the full or partial genetic puzzle pictures of 22,000 viruses and transferred them onto a single glass slide. Genetic matter from any unidentified virus would bind to any identical genetic matter belonging to a known virus. All you had to do was wash the unidentified genetic material across the slide and see what stuck. It's like you're going through the puzzle store with a single puzzle piece, trying to find the picture it fits into, said Joe. Joe's team took the lung sample sent by the CDC, dissolved it, and washed the genetic material across the viro chip. Bits of it had attached to bits of three different previously identified viruses. A cow coronavirus, a bird coronavirus, and a human coronavirus. It was like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle from three different puzzles, says DeRisi. They didn't fit together. It said to us, this is a novel coronavirus. The new virus's similarity to known viruses inside cows, birds, and people did not imply that it had come from a cow or a bird or a person. The so-called reservoir species, the animal harboring the virus before the virus jumped into humans, remained a mystery. The virus obviously hadn't come from humans. If it had, humans would have some immunity to it, which they clearly did not. Joe was fairly certain that the virus hadn't come from cows either, as the viruses that threatened money-making animals tended to be thoroughly studied and well-known. Investigators would wind up grabbing animals across China until they found the SARS virus inside one of them, reproducing without sickening the animal. To the surprise of all, the new virus's old home turned out to be the horseshoe bat. No one had ever seen bat coronaviruses, said Joe. They didn't exist. To the Jasons, Joe explained how the viro chip had taken the guesswork out of the investigation. When some new pathogen infected human beings, you didn't need some expert virologist to make guesses about what it might be. You could now approach the pathogen without any knowledge or preconception and allow its genes to tell you what it was. The biology would reveal itself if you gave it a chance. There was much that Joe didn't explain to the Jasons that day. He didn't explain, for instance, where the viro chip had come from, How it was an extension of a massive machine he'd built with his own hands as a Stanford graduate student. Or how he'd also built the robot that placed genetic sequences of 22,000 viruses onto a glass slide. He didn't explain that those sequences were, by necessity, only partial genetic pictures of each virus, as the full ones would never fit onto a single glass slide. To maximize the likelihood of detecting a new virus, he and his team had put onto the virochip the oldest gene sequences of each known virus. Those strings of genes that had been preserved even after the virus had evolved. If the virus further evolved into something that seemed entirely new, it likely would continue to possess those old sequences. In his speech, Joe didn't go into any of that. The Jasons were busy men. They'd given him just 10 minutes to say what he had to say, and they had questions. If the unidentified virus is a new virus, why would it stick to any place on the virochip? People always asked this. All viruses on Earth are genetically related, Joe explained, because they'd evolved from common ancestors. If a virus is new, and thus doesn't match up perfectly with the DNA on the chip can still lead you to its family, its grandparents, or, at least, its distant cousins. The chip, in other words, could be used not just to diagnose an existing virus, but to discover a new one, as it had with SARS. And its power to diagnose grew with the addition of new viruses to the chip. What if the virus had zero genetic connection to any virus on Earth? What if it came from Mars? Another common question, and harder to answer satisfactorily. There actually was a phrase, the dark matter of genomic sequencing. It referred to genetic material without any connection to known genetic material. But SARS wasn't that. And neither were any of the other likely biological threats to humans. Why had the virus vanished? Why had it infected 8,000 people and killed 800 of them and then just stopped? Where had it gone? The first SARS outbreak had ended because those infected had been isolated quickly and prevented from infecting others. Those capable of infecting others were easy to identify because they were so obviously ill. There were few, if any, asymptomatic spreaders. The virus had not vanished, however. It's still out there, said Joe. It didn't come from outer space. There's a very meaningful probability that it can arise again. In other words, now was not the time to chill out on biological threats. Too little was known. Even about SARS, much remained a mystery. How it had passed from person to person, for example. In the fall after the first SARS outbreak, the World Health Organization published a report. To Joe, this report was as good as any detective story. It explored what had happened after a doctor had traveled with his wife from their home in mainland China to Hong Kong to attend a wedding. The doctor had died and sickened people in 5 other rooms on the same floor of Hong Kong's Metropole Hotel. The question was, how did they get it? 2 months after the hotel outbreak, a team from WHO had visited the Metropole and treated it as a crime scene. They'd searched for the virus's genetic material in the carpets and curtains and even in dust in the air. They tested the plumbing and the ventilation. They swabbed the maid's vacuum cleaners and the janitor's closets. They discovered, for instance, that the hotel's air conditioning pushed air ever so gently from the rooms out into the corridors. They paid special attention to the room in which the doomed Chinese doctor and his wife had stayed, 9/11. Inside, they could find no trace of the virus. Outside in the hall, they hit pay dirt. 2 months after the death of the Chinese doctor, his killer's genetic material was still very much there, in a big circle on the carpet near the door. Most of the others on the 9th floor of the Metropole Hotel who had contracted the virus had one thing in common. To get from their rooms to the elevator, they'd had to walk past room 911. The WHO team wondered if perhaps these people had walked through this very spot and later, when they removed their shoes, had infected themselves. They further surmised that the doctor had vomited on the carpet, then cleaned up the mess himself, as the hotel had no record of a call for help. But in truth, they were just guessing. No one knew. When Joe was finished speaking, he was escorted from the room so that he wasn't exposed to classified information. He realized that the Jasons had asked him a bunch of questions without ever getting to the most important one. How do we use this new technology to get a jump on the viruses of the future? Viruses had a natural edge on people. They deliberately make errors in their genetic code, said Joe. They evolved to make mistakes, and their mistakes give them an evolutionary flexibility that is unprecedented. We needed to be able to respond to the special power of viruses by speeding up our ability to understand them. It was after that first outbreak of a new coronavirus that Joe's phone got named the Red Phone. We had gained some fame during the SARS thing, and we began to get cold called, he said. If you've tried everything else and you don't know what it is, you can pick up the phone and call us. The urgent cries for help he classified into two very broad categories. The first concerned the extinction, or at least a big die-off of some animal species without commercial value, the snakes, for example. In early 2009, Joe got a letter from a woman who enclosed a picture of herself wrapped in a boa constrictor. I heard you're a virus hunter, it began, before explaining that the snake in the photograph was her service animal. His name was Mr. Larry, she wrote. Her snake's veterinarian had heard Joe speak about this new chip he had created to identify viruses. Might he use it to investigate the mysterious illness killing snakes across the world before it carried away Mr. Larry? All of this came as news to Joe. He had no idea snakes could be of service, or that they were dying in large numbers from some new illness. I thought, wow, that's crazy, he recalled. I let the letter sit on my desk for maybe a year. It was a weird letter. Joe loved science. He also thought that science was in some ways misunderstood, at least as it was often taught to children. After the fact, scientific progress was often described as a cool antiseptic affair. A lone scientist or a team of scientists had formed some hypothesis, created a way to test it, and discovered some new truth or not. Joe thought that scientists should be encouraged to look at stuff without having any idea of what they were looking for. There's a time and a place for a hypothesis, said Joe, and there's a time and a place to let it go. He also thought that people who looked at stuff without any preconception of what they might find were the ones who saw the things that no one had seen before. It's science's dark secret, he said. If you actually look at the great discoveries, okay, maybe not in astrophysics, but in medicine and biology, you don't have to go back more than a couple of steps to find a chance observation. Science was just curiosity's tool. Progress often began when someone saw something they hadn't expected to see and said, huh, that's weird. And so, that's weird, when said by Joe, was less a footnote of mild interest than a prologue to an investigation. At length, his curiosity got the better of him. He called Mr. Larry's vet. Is it true that snakes are dying of some mysterious disease? He asked. Oh, yeah, said the vet, as if everyone knew this. Zoos everywhere were seeing their snake populations being wiped out. I then went on YouTube and typed in, "Hey, my snake is sick," said Joe. And all these videos start popping up from all over the world. Whatever it was made the snakes go crazy. Have you ever seen a python go crazy? He soon found himself trying to understand what amounted to a snake pandemic. In the 5 years since the DeRisi lab had helped to identify SARS, the virus hunter's arsenal had expanded. Big, fast genomic sequencing machines had come onto the market to do what the Virochip had done, but with even more fantastic possibilities. Instead of washing genetic material across a glass slide, you now dumped that material into the magical gene machine and let the machine figure out what it was. The machine busted up the genetic material into fragments and, in effect, handed you back a million little jigsaw puzzle pieces. You could then take the puzzle pieces and see where they belonged by comparing them to the puzzles stored in GenBank. The Virochip had allowed Joe to identify only the pieces of virus that stuck to it. The new machine allowed him to inspect any genetic material that didn't belong. Say, for example, he got sent genetic material from a human being with a mysterious illness. He could identify all the human genetic material in the sample and discard those puzzle pieces, as the human genome was fully known. What remained was whatever genetic puzzle pieces did not belong inside a human. Not just viruses, but bacteria and single-cell organisms and anything else that might have taken up residence. He could then take those pieces and compare them to everything in GenBank. It's like you get these pieces and you go into a giant warehouse of puzzles, said Joe, and you look for which puzzle the piece fits into. The new technology worked great for humans, or for that matter, any species whose genome was fully known. Snakes were not one of them. Who founded the Python Genome Project? Said Joe. No one. And so that's what he first did. He took his team of postdocs to a San Francisco aquarium, extracted the blood of a healthy boa, and set about creating, in essence, the puzzle picture of a snake. Once they'd finished, he was able to extract genetic material from a snake that had died of the mysterious illness, dump it into the new gene machine, wait for it to spit out all the puzzle pieces, and throw out everything that belonged in the genetic picture of a snake. The whole game is to separate everything that is snake from everything that is not snake, then see what is not snake, said Joe. Snakes that had died of the mysterious illness indeed harbored a previously unidentified virus. The DeRisi lab could see that it belonged to the family of arenaviruses, which was odd. Arenaviruses had been found in rodents and, on truly unfortunate occasions, in people. Arenaviruses caused Lassa fever and Brazilian hemorrhagic fever, and a few other death sentence diseases. They'd never been found in snakes. Even more strangely, this new snake arenavirus had one genetic sequence in it that was not part of the puzzle picture of any known arenavirus, but it fit into the puzzle of the Ebola virus. What we found was actually an ancient ancestor of Ebola, said Joe. Dinosaurs had this same virus. There's a widely agreed upon standard of proof in virology, collectively called Koch's postulates, for the German doctor who first developed the criteria in the late 19th century. The only way to prove that a virus causes a disease is to isolate the virus and inject it into a healthy animal, Joe explained. If the injection causes the disease, everyone agrees that you've proved your case. To prove that the virus they'd isolated was killing boas and pythons, they'd first need to grow this ancient ancestor of Ebola in the lab, find some healthy boas and pythons, and then infect them with the virus. To inject a virus into an African python took some trouble. Snakes don't have injectable veins. They do, perhaps surprisingly, have hearts, and that's where the virus must be injected. Snake hearts don't stay put like human hearts, but travel up and down the snake's body. To inject a snake's heart with a virus requires 2 postdocs and 1 full professor. 1 to hold the snake in a death grip, and 1 to use a Doppler radar to find the snake's heart, and a 3rd to plunge the needle into it. It seemed exactly the sort of mission that might test the loyalty of a graduate student. The postdocs who spent time in the Derisi lab were, at Joe's insistence, a mixed bag. Biologists, chemists, deep learning specialists, medical doctors of every sort. But they had one thing in common. They were up for anything. "I try to recruit all kinds of people," said Joe. "But the people who are attracted to us would have 0 reservations about jumping onto that ship." The professor and the students injected many boa constrictors and many pythons with the arena virus. The boa constrictors proceeded to sicken and die in exactly the same way as boas in zoos across the world were just then doing. The finding would turn out to be a big win for snakes. A zoo could now quarantine any new boa and test it for the virus before allowing it to socialize with the other snakes. It was also, potentially, a win for human beings, as any virus inside of snakes might one day develop the ability to jump into them too. And if one did, it would be good to know exactly what it was. On top of it all, the Derisi lab had stumbled into a surprising discovery. When they'd injected pythons with the same virus, this ancestor of the Ebola virus that killed boas, the pythons had survived. "Pythons are an old world snake, and boas are a new world snake," said Joe. "This thing that didn't bother old world snakes caused havoc inside new world snakes." He wondered. Perhaps the pythons had survived their injections because they had long ago evolved a tolerance for Ebola. That is, perhaps they were the species in which Ebola was stored. The little game of finding the reservoir species has been easy for coronaviruses, said Joe. No one has ever figured it out for Ebola. People took whole zoos out of Africa, and they never found the animal. There were a couple of ways to solve this mystery. The less satisfying was to travel to Africa and gather a bunch of pythons and see if any harbored the Ebola virus. On one hand, you might find what you were looking for. On the other, if you didn't, that did not mean it did not exist. You might simply have gathered the wrong snakes. "That's the thing in science," said Joe. "Negative data doesn't mean much. You don't get much from it." A more promising approach, he thought, was to grab a python and inject it with live Ebola virus and see what happened. To see if it lived, even as the Ebola replicated inside of it. Like much of what occurred inside the Derisi lab, this was more easily said than done. There were tight restrictions on the use of the live Ebola virus that didn't grant an exemption for even the most curious virus hunter to inject the live virus into the heart of a python. Joe found himself in a long conversation with people inside the laboratory at Fort Detrick in Maryland, where the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases studied biological threats. It was the same lab from which, back in 2001, anthrax had escaped. It had employed the scientist who, in 2008, had committed suicide after being fingered as the likely sender of the letters containing anthrax that had killed 5 Americans. It was the only lab in the United States capable of doing what Joe wanted done. They agreed that it would be useful to find the animal that harbored the Ebola virus, but they also thought that, as Joe put it, this is a crazy-ass experiment. The conversation leading up to the event took months. They ran us through all these decision trees of all the bad things that might happen, said Joe. They got to decision branch number 12 and, I shit you not, it was, what happens if you inject the snake with live Ebola virus and you come back later and there is a hole in the snake's cage and the snake is gone? To which Joe's first response had been, you fucking run. In the end, the U.S. Army's scary lab agreed to take the risks. A brave U.S. Army scientist stabbed pythons in the heart with a needle carrying live Ebola virus, and the snakes lived, had not so much as the sniffles. Even domestic pythons met the first requirement of any reservoir species. Still, it was not enough for the snakes to survive. The Ebola needed to prosper. The Army lab went looking for the Ebola virus inside the snakes, but before they could find it, they got shut down for safety violations. Their lab workers systematically failed to ensure implementation of biosafety and containment procedures commensurate with the risks, said the CDC's report to Congress. And so the mystery remains unsolved. There are some regrets there that we didn't finish, said Joe. But the safety stuff had nothing to do with my snakes. At any rate, that was one kind of urgent call that came into the red phone. Can you help us figure out what is killing all these animals? There was a second kind of call, more urgent than the first. The voice on the other end of the line would say, this person is dying, and we don't know why. Michael Wilson was a medical student at UCSF in 2007 when he first heard Joe DeRisi lecture. The talk was about how the DeRisi lab had helped to identify the original SARS virus. Most medical school lectures aren't suspenseful, he said, but his was a page-turner. Wilson went on to do his residency at Massachusetts General Hospital. His field was neurology, but he had a particular interest in brain diseases, especially those caused by infection. In the United States alone, there were roughly 20,000 cases a year of encephalitis. Encephalitis sounded like a diagnosis, but it was merely a description, a fancy word for inflammation of the brain. Thousands of encephalitis cases a year went undiagnosed. The doctors never learned what it killed the patient. At Mass General and Brigham and Women's Hospital, Wilson sat through a great many stimulating conversations with fellow students and older doctors. A lot of the time the discussion ended with, well, that was a great discussion, but we still have no clue what the person has. At some point during his residency, Wilson realized that if he were to become a neurologist who specialized in infectious disease, he'd spend a lot of time giving up hope. There was a fascination with these patients, he said, but there was also a certain nihilism. Toward the end, he decided that Joe DeRisi and the tool he had created that had identified the SARS virus might be able to help. I wrote him 2 emails during my residency and he didn't respond, recalled Wilson. I couldn't get his attention. Through a mutual friend, a famous neurologist, Wilson arranged to visit Joe in his lab at UCSF. When you talk to Joe, the famous neurologist had said, you'll get the feeling that lightning bolts are about to shoot out of his eyes. Sitting in Joe's office, Wilson saw why Joe hadn't written him back. I looked over his shoulder at his computer, and his inbox had over 13,000 unread emails in it, recalled Wilson. But once Wilson had explained the problem to Joe, Joe agreed on the spot to take Wilson into his lab and to help him figure out whatever was infecting people's brains. As the meeting ended, Joe also said, by the way, other things will come up. What do you mean? Asked Wilson. You'll see, said Joe. Joe then sat Michael Wilson with Mark Stingline the postdoc who had taken the lead on the DeRisi Lab's investigation of snakes. Soon Wilson realized that the DeRisi Lab was to science what Willy Wonka's chocolate factory was to candy. Once a week, recalled Wilson, Joe would come strolling into the lab and say, "I just got a phone call," and it was something about a snake or a polar bear or a parrot. Even though it was unpredictable, it was completely predictable, like lightning bolts. Not long after Wilson arrived, Joe had a phone call from a friend in Wisconsin. The friend, a neurologist, had a patient, a teenage boy, dying in an ICU of some mysterious brain disease. The doctor sent the DeRisi Lab a sample of the kid's spinal fluid, and the lab performed the same trick on it as it had on dead pythons. It took the scientists less than a day to discard the human genetic material and identify what remained. Leptospira bacteria, which in rare cases caused a disease in humans called leptospirosis. They later learned that the boy had traveled to Puerto Rico and had gone swimming in a warm lake. But in the Wisconsin hospital, no one had realized the relevance of that event. There was a cure for leptospirosis, penicillin. There was also a law that prevented labs without formal medical certification from the CDC, labs like the DeRisi Lab, from reporting any results to physicians. By the time they appealed to the CDC, the boy would be dead. Joe had sat down with UCSF's resident bioethicist, his actual title, and whatever he had said, it had been persuasive. Joe told his friend what he'd found, and his friend gave penicillin to the boy, and inside of a week, the boy walked out of the hospital. He even sent them a video. "Hey, you guys, thanks for saving my life." That sort of happy thing happened every so often during the 3.5 years Michael Wilson spent in the DeRisi Lab. But the red phone was wildly unsystematic, and the central truth about it was that by the time people rang it, it was usually too late. The calls would come only after some doctor, desperate for help, read about the DeRisi Lab, or more commonly, after someone who knew Joe or Michael Wilson met someone who knew someone who was in trouble. If you happened to be dying of an unknown brain disease, your chances of survival rose if you had no more than 2 degrees of separation from either Michael Wilson or Joe DeRisi. "Joe called it Michael Wilson's friends and family plan," said Wilson. "But it was really Michael and Joe's friends and family plan." The Chinese woman was case in point. They'd only heard about her because she'd eventually turned up in a UCSF hospital, where she was treated by doctors who were friends of both Michael and Joe. The story, in Joe's telling, began in July 2014, when the 74-year-old woman, who spoke no English, walked into San Francisco's Chinese hospital. She had a fever and felt shaky. The doctors suspected a urinary tract infection, gave her antibiotics, and sent her home. 3 weeks later, on August 1st, the woman appeared in St. Mary's Medical Center with fever and a cough and loss of vision. This time, the doctors did an MRI. The picture of her brain suggested that she'd suffered many tiny strokes. They gave her anticoagulants to reduce the risk of stroke and sent her home. 2 days later, her relatives wheeled her into one of UCSF's hospitals, comatose. The doctors ran her through the MRI machine again. Suddenly, her scans showed massive cell death in her brain. There was very little brain left to save. Still, UCSF's doctors did everything they could think of to save it. They gave her expensive drugs that killed fungal infections and more expensive drugs that killed parasites. And just one morning, they gave her $150,000 worth of medications. None of it had the slightest effect. On August 15th, they removed a piece of her brain and found nothing unusual. A week later, on August 22nd, they did another biopsy, and this time found that the blood vessels in the woman's brain were all dead. No one knew why. And yet, It wasn't until 2 days later, on August 24th, 45 days after the woman walked into a hospital and 3 weeks since she'd arrived at UCSF, that anyone thought to call the red phone. 4 days later, she was dead. Her hospital bill came to $1,100,000, and why they didn't just round it to the nearest million was an open question. So still was her disease. Looking into the woman's brain, the UCSF pathologists had decided that the little critters that had overrun the healthy brain cells were human immune cells, doing their best to attack some unidentified infection. The cause of that infection was the mystery. The DeRisi lab ran the woman's spinal fluid through the gene machine. A few hours later, it spat back a picture, broken up into tiny pieces. Of the 19 million genetic sequences in the fluid, all but 1,863 were human. 1,863 puzzle pieces that did not belong inside a human brain. When compared to the existing puzzle pictures, 1,377 matched nothing at all. But the other 486 fit perfectly into known pictures of a pathogen called Balamuthia mandrillaris. The puzzle picture of Balamuthia was incomplete. Its genome had been only partially sequenced. The amoeba had been discovered in 1986 in a dead mandrill in the San Diego Wild Animal Park, hence its name. Since then, it had been defined mainly by how little anyone knew about it. So little about it was known that a trained pathologist had stared at a picture of it and mistaken it for human immune cells. It had been detected only a few dozen times since its discovery, once in a dead 4-year-old girl. No one knew what it ate when it wasn't eating the brains of mandrills or humans. No one knew, really, how it entered people. Asked to explain what he'd found, Joe would only say, "Balamuthia is an amoeba and it eats your brain, and there is no cure." By then, Michael Wilson had seen the DeRisi lab work its magic often enough that he almost took it for granted. What struck him was what Joe did next. "He could have just left it there," said Wilson. "He could have said, 'There, we found what it was,' just like he could have said, 'We found a snake virus,' and moved on. But he didn't leave it there." Having identified and isolated Balamuthia, Joe wondered if the lab might also find a cure for it. After all, if the DeRisi lab didn't find the cure for Balamuthia, who would? No drug company would bother. There was no money in Balamuthia cures. There were only a handful of cases each year. Joe asked his team to test every drug that had been approved by either the U.S. Food and Drug Administration or the European regulators. No weird Russian shit, as Joe put it. The postdocs subjected Balamuthia to the 2,177 drugs known to have done no harm to humans. Each day, they'd remove the amoeba from its place on the rack in the world's most dangerous refrigerator and see if any of the drugs might kill it. "It's scary to work with," one of the postdocs confessed, but then suddenly it wasn't. Because one of the approved drugs indeed killed the amoeba. Nitroxylline, it was called. Joe and his postdocs wrote up their findings and published the result in MBio, a microbiology journal, in October 2018. There were several points to this story. One was how screwed up the incentives were inside the medical industrial complex. It was possible to spend $1,100,000 on drugs to prevent you from dying without anyone's having any idea if any of them would work. At the same time, inside of a few weeks but too late to save you, some ill-paid postdoc was able to find a cheap cure. Another was that even when you might have thought that problem was solved, it wasn't. 2 years after Joe and his postdocs published their findings on Balamuthia, the FDA had yet to approve nitroxylline, long since cleared by European regulators as a treatment. The CDC website continued to recommend an old treatment, another one of the 2,177 drugs that the DeRisi lab had demonstrated did nothing but create unpleasant side effects, which is to say that American citizens could and would die of balamuthia without ever knowing what they had or that there was a cure. Unless somehow they'd heard about the red phone. That was Joe's big takeaway from the story, what he called the last mile problem in medical science. Corporations were interested only in stuff that made money. Academics were interested in anything worthy of publication, but once they had their paper done, they tended to lose interest. The government was meant to fill in the blanks, but the United States government by now mystified Joe. He'd visited the CDC to explain the new genomic technology, only to be met with boredom and blank stares. In the Food and Drug Administration, there was one woman, a single human being, trying to curate the academic literature so that doctors and patients could easily access new knowledge. She'd taken it upon herself. No one had asked her to do it. It's often individuals who pick up the baton, and they're not even doing it as part of their day job description, said Joe. Scattered throughout those organizations, there are these people. But they aren't organized, trying to compensate for the deficiencies in the system. The red phone could save your life if you called it in time. The system had configured itself in such a way that, more often than not, you didn't. On the 1st of January 2020, Joe DeRisi was passing through the airport in Guangdong on his way to Cambodia. In addition to his lab at UCSF, he now ran a peculiar new institution called the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub, created with a $600 million gift from the Facebook founder and his wife, the pediatrician Priscilla Chan. It had set itself a preposterous goal: to eliminate all disease on Earth by the end of the 21st century. Chan then asked herself, who on Earth might actually be able to do that? As a medical student at the University of California, San Francisco, she'd heard Joe DeRisi lecture. She thought he might be able to do that. Just then, Joe was flying to Cambodia to install a node in what he hoped would one day be a global network to detect disease. Early warning radar for emerging pathogens, he called it. It was an idea that had once interested the U.S. government. The original pandemic plan, conceived by the Bush White House, spawned a program called PREDICT, which set out to test animals around the world to determine which contained viruses that might jump into people. The Trump administration had zeroed out the program's funding, and so PREDICT, in the end, failed to predict anything. That didn't trouble Joe so much as the thought that the BioHub, using genomic technology, had found a simpler, more practical way to achieve the same goals: by catching any new virus the moment it appeared in humans. When some child appeared in a Cambodian emergency room with a fever of unknown origin, Cambodian doctors, newly schooled by Joe in the use of genomic technology, would be able to figure out instantly what had caused it. If it had not been seen before in humans, they'd know that too. The natural home of such an ambitious global project was the U.S. government or the World Health Organization. The absence of pandemic prevention was another example of a deficiency in the system. Compared to its expected benefits, its costs were trivial, but no one company or person had the incentive to attack the problem. We went to the CDC and pitched them, and we were given a fairly cold reception, said Joe. And we were like, we'll pay for it. And they were like, huh? That's weird. They basically didn't care. Walking out, I kind of knew in my gut we'd have to go it alone. In the end, the BioHub had partnered with another nonprofit, the Gates Foundation, to build, in effect, a global network of infectious disease tripwires. Joe reckoned they'd have the system in place by 2022. It wouldn't be seamless, China would remain a black hole as the Chinese had declined to participate. But Joe thought they could see what they needed to see inside China by creating tripwires in surrounding countries. That was one reason Cambodia was important and why he was on his way there. It was close to China and a draw for Chinese tourists. If a new virus ever took a trip out of China, Cambodia would likely be an early stop. He spent 10 days in and around Phnom Penh and left feeling good about his new friend's ability to work the gene machine. It was the flight home on January 10, 2020, that he found unsettling. He changed planes again in Guangdong, the province from which the Chinese doctor, the superspreader of SARS, had come. The airport was transformed. There were now lots of security people wearing masks. Passengers were required to step, one by one, inside an acrylic stall and be scanned for fever. "They weren't fooling around," said Joe. I thought, what the hell is going on? He'd never seen a fever box and, as he stepped inside, he had a feeling in the pit of his stomach. I thought, these people know something. We don't. 7. The Redneck Epidemiologist. It had been more than a decade since they'd served together in the White House, but whenever Richard Hatchett wanted to noodle over some problem, his first impulse was to write to Carter Mesher. Richard had moved to London back in 2017 to run a curious new organization called the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. CEPI, as it was simply and thankfully known, had been funded by European governments, the Gates Foundation, and others with deep pockets to develop new vaccines and faster ways to make them. On January 8, 2020, Richard had been going back and forth with Carter on something or other when Carter changed the subject. Carter's mind had drifted from the assigned task to a new and more interesting one. On a different note, he wrote, "I saw that a novel coronavirus was isolated in the China outbreak." Carter had been back in Atlanta for 9 years. He'd left the White House at the end of President Obama's first term and returned to the Veterans Health Administration in Atlanta. The people around him either never knew or soon forgot where he'd been for the previous 6 years and what he'd done there. No one ever brought up the White House or pandemics. As he'd given up his position running hospitals, the VA just called him Senior Medical Advisor, which meant that he could do pretty much anything he wanted to do, wherever he wanted to do it. "They just sort of forgot Carter existed," said Richard. Every now and then, someone gave Carter a task, but mostly he found problems on his own inside the VA and worked on them. He became curious how the VA's hospital staff used their sick leave, for instance, and figured out that the number of sick days taken by nurses correlated strongly with flu activity, so that you could use flu activity to predict nurse shortages. For a long stretch, he worked on making the hospitals more efficient. The Veterans Health Administration, soon after Carter returned to it, had gotten into hot water after veterans complained about long wait times. One guy had waited 6 months to see a cardiologist had died of a heart attack before his first appointment. "So the question is, why is that occurring?" asked Carter. "Is it because the doctors are so busy and overworked and understaffed that patients are backed up? Or is it because the practice is inefficient?" He found a woman named Eileen Moran who'd been working on how to measure the performance of the VA's doctors. She was not popular with the VA's top brass. "They wanted to shut her down," said Carter. "But I looked into it and I said, this is really good." Carter teamed up with Moran to create a system that allowed the VA to see when veterans weren't being cared for, whether the problem in any given case was a shortage of doctors or deficiency in the way those doctors practiced medicine, all of which was part of a bigger problem that he wanted to tackle: how any big government agency allocates its resources. Each year, Congress would hand more than $100 billion to Veterans Affairs, and various people inside the VA would pay for more than they'd gotten the year before. The top brass had no way to figure out who was actually busting their ass and needed more help and who was loafing. "It wound up being who has whose ear," said Carter. "I saw all that and I hated it." He hated in particular the way some people were able to use their own inefficiency to create a seeming need for more funding. And other people, people with a gift for making do with less, were, as a result, given even less. "It drove out the entrepreneurial spirit," said Carter. "It made me wish I had a system to figure out what the hell was going on." At any rate, he was never idle. At the end of each year, he was able to find stuff to fill in the 4 or 5 pages of his self-assessment report. But he was, in effect, managing himself. "I think they totally lost track of me," he said. "It gave me so much freedom to play." Outside the VA, at least a few people from his White House days had not lost track of Carter Mesher. Tom Bossert, for example. As Deputy Homeland Security Advisor to George W. Bush, Bossert had watched Carter and Richard reinvent pandemic planning, reinterpret the greatest pandemic in human history, resurrect the idea that a society could control a new disease by using social distancing in its various forms, and then somehow lead the CDC to the conclusion that the whole thing had been their idea. Donald Trump had shunned most anyone associated with any former president, but had made an exception of Bossert, whom he'd named his first Homeland Security advisor. "The job I had was chief risk officer for the country," said Bossert, "and it should have been named that." After his appointment, Bossert built a team of people to deal with biological risks and instantly called Richard Hatchett and Carter Mesher. "I just want you to know that if the shit hits the fan, the first call I'm making is to you," he'd said. He considered clearing Carter and Richard into the White House in the first days of the Trump administration, so that in the event of some disease outbreak, they could fly in and get right to work. But then, on April 9th, 2018, Trump hired John Bolton as his national security advisor, and the next day, Bolton fired Tom Bossert and demoted or fired everyone on the biological threat team. From that moment on, the Trump White House lived by the tacit rule last observed by the Reagan administration. The only serious threat to the American way of life came from other nation states. The Bush and Obama administration's concern with other kinds of threats was banished to the basement. Bolton redesigned the White House to focus on hostile foreign countries rather than, say, natural disasters or disease. Bad people rather than bad events. In a world of limited resources, you have to pick and choose, an anonymous Trump White House person told the Washington Post. And so, on January 8, 2020, as Carter typed his email to Richard, in which he noted this new coronavirus in China, he was sitting not in the White House, nor even inside Veterans Affairs, but at the Ethan Allen cherry-top desk just off his bedroom. He may not have been in his underpants, but then, he might have been too. Carter and Richard had never really stopped working together. Around them, a small group had formed, 7 men, all doctors. All were younger, some a generation younger than Carter, who was about to turn 65. Most had seen combat in Iraq, and all at one point or another had worked with Carter in the White House. All except Rajiv Venkayah, who had brought Carter and Richard into the White House in the first place and now ran vaccine development for one of Asia's biggest drug companies, had served in the military. Dwayne Kaniva and James Lawler had come from the U.S. Navy, Matt Hepburn and Dave Marcosi from the U.S. Army, and all had a role to play in the event of any pandemic. Lawler ran the Global Center for Health Security at the University of Nebraska, for instance. That was the federally funded facility to which any American infected with some deadly new pathogen was likely to be sent to be studied and cared for. They'd treated some of the Ebola patients. For more than a decade, the seven doctors had come together each time a biological threat presented itself. MERS, Ebola, Zika. They'd all been involved in each of those outbreaks, one way or another, behind the scenes. In flurries of phone calls and emails, they'd seek to figure out what was going on and what each might do to influence the situation and save lives. They might be mistaken for a secret society if the person at the center were not so insistently happy to share his thoughts with anyone who asked. They'd even been given a name, Wolverines. A former Bush White House colleague had come up with that, and somehow it had stuck. A reference to the 1980s dystopian Cold War film, Red Dawn. The Soviets have successfully invaded the United States. Some American high school classmates operating from the mountains outside of Denver create the resistance. They call themselves Wolverines after their high school mascot. Carter was never exactly sure how much he resembled a guerrilla fighter and who were the Soviets in the analogy, but he thought it was kind of fun that the group had a name. Carter mentioned the novel coronavirus in his email to Richard, on which he copied the other five doctors. Then he vanished, and they were mystified. Carter hadn't bothered to mention that he was setting out with his wife on a long, quiet drive to the remote place that their son had chosen for his wedding. The others quickly noted his absence. Carter was always the first to leap into any new disease outbreak and make original sense of it, in much the same way he had made sense of the 1918 pandemic. He had no formal training in epidemiology or virology or any other relevant field. He simply had a nose for data and an ability to squeeze the meaning from it. At the start of any outbreak, Carter was back in the ICU again. He had a gift in a crisis for figuring out what was going on while there was still time to do something about it. Most of our calls start off with, "Carter, what are you thinking?" said Dwayne Kaniva, who was, in January 2020, the chief medical officer of the Department of Homeland Security. He's like a savant on all this stuff. 9 days into Carter's silence, on January 18th, the world was still paying little attention to what appeared to be a small local outbreak. The World Health Organization was saying that there was no sustained human-to-human transmission of the virus, and the Chinese government was allowing 40,000 families in Wuhan to gather for an annual celebration, complete with a buffet. And still, no sign of Carter. And so James Lawler finally stepped in. "Saw unconfirmed reports today of 17 more cases in Wuhan," he wrote to the others. "So I got to thinking and pulled a Carter. Is it likely that this thing is much larger than what we are seeing?" That day was the first in more than a week since the Chinese had announced new cases. The total number of infected people had risen from 45 to 62, most of them in Wuhan. Outside of China, two cases had already been identified in people who had traveled from Wuhan, one in Thailand, the other in Japan. Lawler pointed to those two cases and asked, "What were the odds that there were fewer than 100 cases in all of China if there were already two infected international travelers from Wuhan?" Then he launched into a Carter-like back-of-the-envelope calculation, which is to say that it was both academically laughable and fantastically insightful. Redneck epidemiology. Lawler began by noting that Chinese travelers had made 131 million foreign trips in 2017, the most recent year for which he could find the data. Wuhan contained 11 million people, slightly less than 1% of the country's population. Its citizens were perhaps more cosmopolitan than the average Chinese and more likely to travel abroad, and so Lawler granted that they might do more than their share of foreign travel. He did some math and estimated that, in any given two-week period, the people of Wuhan made 15,000 trips abroad. He then proposed that those people who had remained in Wuhan, where the coronavirus was at large, were at least as likely to be infected as those who had made trips outside the country. My estimate is that during the first 2 weeks in the month, there were at least 3,000 cases in Wuhan, he wrote, and that assumes that all infected travelers are being identified, which is obviously not true. It was a funny way to approach a problem, by first imagining how Carter Mesher might approach it. If you were going to approach a problem pretending to be Carter, you didn't worry about finding the perfect answer. There might never be a perfect answer. To this day, no one knows how many people in Wuhan were infected on January 18th, 2020, but everyone now agrees it was a lot more than 62. In March 2020, a mathematical epidemiologist in Hong Kong published a paper estimating that by January 23rd, there were between 1,000 and 5,000 infected Wuhanese. But once you got past the necessary imprecision, you arrived at a better place.